for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink, technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Gail Harris. Coming up, airline passengers may soon be tagged with a personal threat level.
And the largest military force enters Guadalcanal since World War II. International peacekeepers step in to stabilize a troubled island.
There was an agreement reached with militia leaders to agree to hand in weapons. And the weapons range from World War II explosives to homemade rifles to high-powered military assault rifles.
Also, Al-Qaeda's new weapon of choice, the poppies of Afghanistan.
The economy shows some signs of recovery.
Corporate pension plans, though, are ailing.
These stories and the music of jazz great Charlie Hayden, coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. A U.S. soldier was killed today when an armored personnel carrier hit a landmine on a stretch of road leading to the Baghdad airport. Three other soldiers were injured. The head of U.S. forces in Iraq says soldiers are coming up against increasingly sophisticated explosive devices. NPR's Eric Westerveld reports from Baghdad.
Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez said the U.S. continues to fight a low-intensity conflict in parts of Iraq, mainly in Baghdad and the Sunni Triangle west and north of the city. The commander of U.S. ground forces here said the tactical sophistication of the ambushes are still basic hit-and-run attacks, but Sanchez said they are seeing more advanced explosive devices and techniques.
Are there timers being put on it, improvised explosives? Are there trip wires being used? The enemy is increasing the sophistication of those explosive devices, and they're using all types of ammunition.
Ammunition ranging from plastic explosives to mortars rigged to go off by remote control. In the last 2 weeks alone, attacks on U.S. forces in Iraq have killed 19 soldiers. Eric Westerveld, NPR News, Baghdad.
Iraq's civil administrator Paul Bremer says Iraqis could hold general elections by the middle of next year. He says first, a new constitution has to be drafted and ratified in a referendum. Many UN member nations have been hesitant to send peacekeeping troops into Iraq while the country is under U.S. occupation and administration. The Department of Homeland Security has scaled back a plan to examine the backgrounds of airline passengers because of privacy concerns. The new version of the CAPS II system will simply try to verify that passengers are who they say they are. NPR's Larry Abramson reports the system is designed to stop terrorists.
DHS officials have been working on an enhanced version of the computer-assisted passenger pre-screening system, or CAPS, which has been used for years to identify high-risk passengers. But privacy advocates attacked the proposal, saying the agency wanted to rake through credit records and medical information in the search for possible terrorists. In response, the new proposal will only use commercial databases to verify a passenger's identity. Credit and medical information will not be examined, and any data would be destroyed shortly after the trip. Privacy advocates are concerned, however, that the new system will look beyond terrorism and stop passengers with outstanding warrants for crimes of violence. They also worry that flyers could be stopped if they're suspected of violating immigration laws. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
The UN War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague has acquitted a prominent Bosnian Serb politician of genocide during the Bosnian War, but it found that 41-year-old Milimir Stokic was guilty of persecution, murder, and extermination of Bosnian Muslims and Croats, and it sentenced him to life in prison. On Wall Street, just before news time, the Dow Industrials were up 142 points to 93.42. The Nasdaq was up 31. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the gross domestic product rose 2.4% during the second quarter. That was better than Wall Street analysts had been expecting, and it was the strongest showing in nearly a year. The GDP measures the total value of goods and services produced within the U.S. It's considered the broadest barometer of the economy's health. OPEC oil ministers have agreed to hold production levels steady. They'll decide in September whether to cut production with the expected rise in post-war oil production in Iraq. OPEC did not invite Iraq to today's meeting in Vienna, and NPR's Ivan Watson reports Iraqis are angry at being shut out.
Iraqi oil ministry executive Shamki Faraj says he was not invited to the OPEC meeting because the organization does not recognize the U.S.-backed administration in Baghdad as a legitimate government. Faraj also says, after many delays, his country is finally expected to start exporting a steady stream of crude oil in August to the tune of some 700,000 barrels a day.
This is a smaller quantity with regard to the what was expected from Iran.
U.S. officials here predicted much higher sales of Iraqi oil in the months following the war. Profits were to then be used to finance the reconstruction of the country. But American officials say they did not anticipate the destruction caused by post-war looting and sabotage of oil installations and pipelines. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Kirkuk, Iraq.
Higher gas and oil prices have sent ExxonMobil's quarterly profits higher than last year's earnings. The company says it earned $4.17 billion in the second quarter. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris, and for Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Congress has rejected a Bush administration plan to cut back the nation's Air Marshal program. Lawmakers called the idea crazy and mind-boggling, especially in light of a warning issued earlier this week that al-Qaeda terrorists are planning new suicide attacks using airplanes. Yesterday, President Bush said precautions are being taken both at home and abroad.
Now, what we can do is we can be, obviously, at home, continue to be diligent on the inspection process of baggage, as well as making sure those who board aircraft are properly screened. And obviously, we're talking to foreign governments and foreign airlines to indicate to them the reality of the threat.
The Homeland Security Department is also expected to announce today that it's ready to begin testing a computer-assisted passenger screening program, which came under fire last year from civil libertarians who had privacy concerns. Joining us to discuss the state of the nation's airport security is Sarah Gu, who has been covering the story for The Washington Post. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Tell us first why this about-face over the Air Marshal funding, because it certainly sounds like a case of the right hand just not knowing what the left hand was doing.
On one hand, the government has ramped up security for airplanes very quickly after 9/11, and now, you know, as we get further away from that date, they're now looking to trim the budget and reduce the number of security screeners and become more efficient. And unfortunately, this came just at the time that the government received this latest and very serious hijacking threat.
And was this an embarrassment for the administration?
Clearly, they changed their mind pretty quickly, and they only do that when I think they are embarrassed or they realize that something critical needs to be changed. And in this case, the agency was caught, you know, red-handed. Here we are after 9/11 getting a little bit more comfortable as the further we get out. And in this instance, the government is trying now to look tough. It came out today with a new program to screen passengers that it feels will not only ferret out possible terrorists, but also violent criminals.
Well, tell us some more about that, because this one has been scaled back because of those civil liberties concerns that we were mentioning earlier. What were those concerns exactly, and how are they now being addressed?
Well, this program deals with a computer screening program. It's based on your address, your phone number, basic information about you. The government said that this program was outdated, and it would flag certain passengers only if they bought, for example, a one-way ticket or paid with cash. They wanted to expand that program, but the program has been delayed several times because of these concerns about how deep the government would probe into someone's background.
Well, for example, if you had ever had treatment for psychiatric problems, would that be the sort of information that would pop up?
The government is indicating that that kind of thing, they say, would not be probed by the government. The most significant thing that they said that they've changed that really alarmed these civil libertarians before was that at first they planned to keep the information about you for as long as 50 years. They decided to dismiss that component of it and instead it will keep information only as long as a couple of hours.
And there's another big issue in airport security right now, and that's a plan to require international airline passengers who make stopovers in the United States get visas, because right now they don't have to do that. So how would that work exactly, and what effect is that likely to have?
It's really this very small number of passengers and flights that arrive in the U.S. from an international destination, let's say a flight from Rio that stops in Miami. The passengers get off the plane refuels, and those passengers who are traveling on to another destination, simply connecting through Miami, do not have to get a U.S. visa. But in this most recent hijacking alert, government intelligence says that terrorists might be attempting to exploit that loophole by hijacking such planes, because they wouldn't need to apply for a visa and they would therefore escape the attention of authorities.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Sarah Gu is a reporter who covers airline security issues for The Washington Post.
Philippine President Gloria Arroyo said today that the mutiny that took place in her country last weekend is far from over. A formal investigation begins today into what exactly the several hundred soldiers who took over a Manila shopping mall wanted. But questions are also being raised about U.S. military presence in the area. The would-be mutineers claimed that top Filipino military officials staged bombings in Muslim areas of the Philippines, prompting concerns that the military assistance the U.S. is giving the Philippines is based on trumped-up evidence of terrorism. Joining us on the line is Paolo Pasicolan. He's a policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. Paolo, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, because of this attempted bloodless coup, Top General Victor Corpus resigned his post as Chief of Army Intelligence. He was directly accused by name of staging some of these bombings. So what do you think is happening here?
Well, I think this is very indicative of the situation in the Philippines. The Philippine people have gotten used to changing governments outside of an election cycle, and that's a bad habit to establish, and unfortunately that's what's happening over there.
In fact, we should remind people that current President Arroyo was vice president to President Estrada, who is now imprisoned and charged with all sorts of things.
That's true. And she came to power under, well, relatively dubious constitutional circumstances.
Well, going back to General Corpus, who resigned, do you think that he was falling on his sword to stop these mutineers' allegations from getting too much scrutiny?
Well, if he did, and if his resignation was his attempt to end this this scrutiny over the military, then it would have been a very foolish attempt to fall on his sword, because certainly this will be the focus of Philippine politics for the next couple of months, because it's a very, very serious breakdown in the subordination of the military under civilian rule.
The mutineers are also claiming that some Philippine soldiers are selling ammunition to the rebels, and the rebels have confirmed that. And this raises the other troubling prospect that U.S. soldiers are there training the Filipino soldiers. They're both supposed to be fighting the rebels, and here, perhaps, at least the Filipino soldiers are arming them.
That's true. That's a there are some questions the United States has to face in this situation. Firstly, is our military assistance helping or hurting the Philippines? Is it effective, basically? And the questions stem from two things. First, if these accusations that the Philippine military are, in fact, backing the rebels in some way or another, or were responsible for the bombings in order to trump up terrorism charges, then that's a serious issue that the United States must consider before approving military assistance.
And let me stop you there for just a second. And what do you think? Do you think that's possible, knowing what you know of the military?
Well, of course, it's too early to tell. But at the same time, I can say that, yes, the military has in the past trumped up, say, a bus bombing that involved a labor dispute in the province, and they immediately accused terrorists, because it does get money from the government, and it gets money also from foreign governments.
Yeah.
The second point, though, is some of the mutineers were actually trained by the U.S. Military recently during a program after 9/11. And it goes to show that the professionalism and the naivete of these soldiers show that maybe our assistance isn't as effective.
Well, it is rare that you have a coup at a mall. How much worse do you think it'll get?
Well, I think it'll start getting better from here. But there are still rumors out there that there a second coup is in the works, and there are still, you know, military people who are disgruntled. So it's definitely not over.
Paolo, thank you.
Thank you.
Paolo Pasi-Colan is a policy analyst at the Asia Studies Center of the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C.
In Liberia today, hundreds of people turned out to welcome the arrival of a small number of West African military experts. But heavy fighting continued as the country awaits the arrival of an international peacekeeping force. West African leaders say the first troops will be in Liberia by Monday. Elsewhere in the world, another multinational force has quietly stepped in to bring calm to yet another troubled country. This time it's the Solomon Islands in the South Pacific. The name many of us know best is that of its largest island, Guadalcanal. It was here that the United States fought some of the toughest battles of the Second World War, and in the process inadvertently sowed seeds for the discontent that lingers today. Now, the largest military force since World War II is beginning to deploy in the Solomons. Some 2,500 troops, along with 300 policemen, are deploying to Guadalcanal. Their mission is to bring stability to a country that is, again, hovering on the edge of civil war. Six Pacific nations are represented among the peacekeepers, but most of them come from Australia. And Hamish Fitzsimmons, a senior reporter with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, joins us now. Hello, Hamish.
Hi, Gail.
Hamish, fill us in on the backstory for a bit here, because when the U.S. drove out the Japanese from the Solomon Islands in World War II, what happened next that helped cause today's problems?
Part of the reconstruction process of the group of islands called the Solomon Islands was that a lot of people were brought over to Guadalcanal from an island called Malaita by the U.S. after the Second World War, and this has been the basis of the ethnic tension, which led to a civil war in 1999-2000, I believe. And a peace deal was brokered then by Australia and New Zealand, and the ethnic tensions have flared up again between the Malaitans and their militia, which was called the Malaitan Eagle Force, and the Guadalcanal locals.
Well, Hamish, as these peacekeepers are arriving, what are they finding there?
There are now 2,500 Australian troops there. Most of the military are there to protect the federal police. The military have, in fact, described themselves as waiters and bouncers for the Australian federal police there. They've found a lot of weapons, and yesterday there was an agreement reached with militia leaders to agree to hand in weapons, and that's already started. The weapons range from World War II explosives to homemade rifles to high-powered military assault rifles. So that's been the biggest breakthrough so far, is agreeing to this amnesty and getting Australian police patrolling the capital of the Solomons with the local police, because that was one of the main problems, that law and order had, in fact, broken down in the Solomons.
Is the basic objective simply to keep these two warring groups apart, or are they a bit more ambitious than that?
I think there is the ambition to get the Solomons working again, basically. There's the real push to rebuild the Solomon Islands government with the Malaitans and with the people of Guadalcanal.
And what's been the reaction in Australia? Are people generally supportive of this, or are they concerned about the precedent that might be being set?
People are very supportive of it. People see the South Pacific Islands as regional neighbours. I mean, Australia is the regional power in the South Pacific, so it sees itself as having a responsibility to maintain stability and stop any internal conflict in these places. It intervened in Bougainville a number of years ago to stop the civil war there, and now the Solomon Islands. So it's pretty much playing the role that I guess the United States does on a much larger level.
Well, Hamish, thank you so much for helping educate us on what's happening in the Solomons.
Thanks, Gail.
Hamish Fitzsimmons is with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. He spoke to us from Sydney.
Just ahead, a bumper crop of opium poppies in Afghanistan.
And later in the program, did your pension plan crash when the stock market tanked?
There's more coming up. Here now. Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Afghanistan, the world's largest grower of opium, has produced another bumper crop this year. Despite the best efforts of the Karzai government, warlords allied with the U.S., along with Taliban fighters and al-Qaeda operatives, are all offering prices for raw opium that poor Afghan farmers can't refuse. That's at the supply side. On the demand side, the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime says the demand for drugs worldwide is still climbing, albeit a little more slowly. To talk about the beginning of the drug food chain, we are joined from Karachi, Pakistan, by Owais Tohid. He writes for the Christian Science Monitor, and he recently traveled to Afghanistan, where he spoke with opium farmers. Owais, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Now, on this trip, you met farmers who are growing as much opium as they possibly can and evidently doing quite well as a result. There was one gentleman in particular, Mr. Bacha. What did he have to say to you?
I met this farmer, 38-year-old Gul Hazrat Bacha, in a small village of Batikot in eastern Afghanistan. And poppy cultivation has changed his life, he told me. Only 2 years ago, Mr. Bacha and his four brothers were growing wheat and were living miserably. And now they make 12 times their former income. And now Mr. Bacha is busy in making himself a new mud house where he's going to shift his children and his wife.
So from his perspective, it's a wonderful thing to grow opium.
Oh, yes. He said that, honestly speaking, like, you know, sort of whatever I have is because of poppy.
Owais, in your recent article, you say that the warlords who are allied with the U.S. are involved in the trade and that, moreover, the Taliban and al-Qaeda are also encouraging farmers to grow more. How did they get involved in this?
Taliban, actually, farmers, they say that Taliban clerics have started preaching. And they are urging farmers to grow more opium, and they're calling it as a way of jihad to destroy the younger generation or future generation of the West and America. And that's how Taliban commanders, military commanders, are getting funds from the smugglers, and they are involved in the drugs inside Afghanistan. And Afghan anti-narcotics official believes that along the borders, al-Qaeda have their network, and they are actually helping international smugglers, or they have got a nexus with international smugglers, because that is the weapon now they want to counter America and the West with.
So basically, both groups know that the West has a thirst for drugs, and so they're happy to oblige.
Yes, they are actually, you know, sort of one. They are now, their policy has changed, and they're countering the West as a weapon, and they're using the drugs as a weapon. At the same time, interesting perception which I noticed during my visits to villages, when some of the farmers say that, you know, yes, we know that it is banned in Islam, but we are not using it. We will stop growing once the people in the West stop using it.
Well, Owais, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Owais Tohid writes for the Christian Science Monitor. Joining us now is Jacob Sullum. He is senior editor at Reason magazine and the author of a new book called Saying Yes, In Defense of Drug Use. Welcome, Jacob.
Thank you.
Well, as we heard a moment ago, Al-Qaeda has, in a sense, thrown down the gauntlet that the West in general and America in particular simply can't satiate its demand for drugs, so Al-Qaeda can just raise money for terror attacks by playing drug dealer. Is that reading of the situation correct, do you think?
Well, I think the crucial element in this is the fact that these drugs are illegal, which is what makes them, first of all, so profitable, and second of all, what makes them benefit criminals and terrorists. If it weren't for the fact that these drugs were illegal, groups like Al-Qaeda would not be profiting from the drug trade.
The UN Office on Drugs and Crime says that nations around the world are simply not succeeding in trying to suppress demand. So never mind for a moment the effort to disrupt the supply. Why are these efforts to contain demand simply not working? And is there anything effective that's out there?
Well, I think it's sort of misleading to make this distinction between supply-side measures and demand-side measures, because supply-side measures are aimed at ultimately affecting the retail price. They're trying to raise the retail price of these drugs and thereby deter people from using them and later on becoming addicted to them. That's the basic idea, and that is the same thing that they're trying to do through the kind of propaganda that we see on TV that tries to discourage people from using drugs at all, from the so-called drug education programs in our schools. It's what they're trying to do through drug testing programs. Now, I think none of these measures have had any kind of measurable impact on either the level of use or the level of abuse, which is really what we ought to be concerned about.
So basically, we could solve two problems at once here, the problem of the Al-Qaeda connection and also the problem of perhaps overcrowded prisons and some of the other issues with drug use in the West now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people should not have unrealistic expectations. As I said, people will always use drugs, and some percentage of the people who use them will abuse them. That's always going to be the case. You're never going to eliminate either use or abuse, but you can certainly make things worse, and I think the policy of prohibition makes things worse in all kinds of ways. The subsidy to terrorism is one example. It also makes drug use much more dangerous, and it imposes costs on people who don't even use drugs. Because they suffer from the theft that is related to prohibition. They suffer from black market violence. They lose their property through asset forfeiture and so on. So there are all kinds of ways in which third parties suffer as well from the policy of prohibition. I don't think in the end that any benefit we have from deterring abuse, which I think is going to be minimal, is worth the cost.
Jacob, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Jacob Sullum is the author of a new book called Saying Yes, In Defense of Drug Use.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, our press panel considers what words do and don't belong in the comics.
And the owner of the racehorse Funny Side helps us review the film Seabiscuit. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. Thank you.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the U.S. economy shows some signs of recovery, especially in defense spending.
And the crisis in corporate pension plans.
These stories and jazz great Charlie Hayden coming up Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Dolores Handy. Liberian President Charles Taylor has agreed to go into exile in Nigeria next week. This is thousands of Liberians are emerging from hiding places in embattled Monrovia to welcome a West African U.S. advance team. President Bush has said that Taylor must step down and a ceasefire must be in place before a U.S. peacekeeping force will be deployed. A U.S. soldier was killed in Iraq today when his armored personnel carrier hit a landmine on the road to Baghdad's airport. It's the second death reported today by the U.S. military. A soldier was shot and killed in an attack northeast of Baghdad late last night. Still, Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Gaynor says soldiers are prepared for a tough ongoing fight.
We expected to continue the mission. We expected that it was going to remain relatively dangerous and challenging for our soldiers, so we didn't have any expectation beyond the fact that we have accomplished that portion of the mission.
So far, 166 American troops have been killed in the Iraq War, 19 more than in the 1991 Gulf War. A British report says the war in Iraq may have done little to reduce international threats and may have actually helped terrorist groups grow stronger. The review comes out of the British House of Commons and concludes that the war may have helped Osama bin Laden recruit new followers by stirring resentment among Muslims in the Gulf region. A British minister says his government stands by its arguments for the war. Japanese lawmakers are headed to Iraq, where they'll decide if that country is safe enough to send Japanese forces to support international peacekeepers. Japan's prime minister says forces would help in rebuilding Iraq as long as it was deemed safe. The prime minister faced opposition by critics within the country opposed to any Japanese military presence. The Vatican is appealing to Catholics and non-Catholics in a new global campaign against gay marriage. The church today released guidelines stressing its opposition to gay marriage and urging Catholic politicians to vote against granting legal rights to same-sex unions. Across Europe, where countries such as Germany legally recognize same-sex civil unions, the edict is being sharply criticized. The public may soon be able to see actual notes written by Watergate reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. Dozens of boxes of Watergate notes and papers from the Washington Post reporters are now at the University of Texas. This is Here and Now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
New numbers out today from the Commerce Department show improvement in this past quarter's gross domestic product. The Labor Department says new applications for unemployment benefits have tapered off. And caretaker of the U.S. economy, Alan Greenspan, is predicting an economic rebound in the second half of this year. But does a rebound mean jobs? On the line is New York Times financial reporter Daniel Altman. And Daniel, last we checked, consumer confidence had plunged. Now we see that the GDP, the total value of goods and services in the U.S., is up. So what does this mean?
There are two different things going on here. The consumer confidence figures and the most recent figures for first-time claims for unemployment benefits are some of the most up-to-date data. The gross domestic product growth, the growth of the economy in the second quarter, is a little bit older. And the 2.4% figure that you saw there is a big improvement over the previous two quarters, where the economy grew at an annual rate of only 1.4%.
Right.
But it's still not enough to create a lot of jobs. For that, you need to get up around 3.5%.
Right. And actually, we read that the unemployment rate might even go higher.
That's true. It tends to be a lagging indicator of the economy, which means that after the economy has already started to grow faster, the unemployment rate can keep growing or not even come down for some months until after that recovery has really been made good.
Right. And back to the GDP, does that mean that people are making things or are people buying those things?
Well, it's both. We have to make them to buy them. The biggest gains in that GDP number were coming from non-residential investment, which is the biggest category of investment by businesses. Also from consumption, that's spending by individuals like you and me.
Mm-hmm.
Government spending, we had the biggest surge in defense spending since the Korean War in 1951, 44%.
Right, that's huge. But the Defense Department spending on things, what does that mean for the rest of us?
Well, they have to buy their armaments and services from people in the economy. But it is a temporary thing, so we should not look at it as something that's going to carry on in the next couple of quarters. We know we will continue to spend about $4 billion a month to keep all of these troops in the Middle East, but that is not necessarily going to translate into huge gains in the economy at home.
Right. You also point out that businesses are finally buying big-ticket items, factories and whatnot. And as we mentioned, there was a slight downturn in people filing for unemployment claims. But what does this mean for job growth? You know, people already out of work.
The first-time claims for unemployment are not really a measure of overall unemployment. The fact that they've gone under 400,000 for a few weeks now is a pretty good sign. However, I would say that we've still got a long way to go. The unemployment rate is at 6.4%, something that would have been considered normal not too many years ago, or at least within the normal range. And I think that it will take some more significant growth in the economy before we see it come down a lot.
Okay. Overall, Daniel, what do you think? Is the painting of the future as, you know, a rebound being around the corner, is that a little too rosy or right on?
I think there's a lot of uncertainty about what the engine is that is going to drive the economy forward. We don't have the same sort of slingshot effect that the big manufacturing sector used to give us in the past. Manufacturing has been becoming a smaller and smaller part of the economy. And the service sector tends to just plateau in bad economic times and then start growing again slowly in a recovery. So a huge acceleration may be an over-optimistic forecast, but as long as the economy can avoid the sorts of shocks that we've had, the corporate scandals, the uncertainty surrounding the war, the terrorist attacks, I think that it has a reasonable chance of returning to what we would consider normal or slightly above average growth.
Right. Well, Daniel, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
New York Times financial reporter Daniel Altman speaking to us from New York.
Another big issue for working Americans is whether they'll have the money to retire when they want to. A concept many people with corporate pensions once took for granted now seems to be turning into a maybe. Some government officials are warning that corporate pension plans could be on the way to collapsing altogether after sinking much of their funds into a stock market that has dropped dramatically in the last 3 years. Joining us on the line now from Washington is Jim McTagg. He's Washington editor for Barron's Business Weekly. Welcome, Jim.
Oh, thank you for having me.
As you know, some are saying that the looming collapse of pension plans takes them back to the savings and loan fiasco of 1989. Is it really that dramatic?
No, it is that dramatic. And let me say that people have cried wolf about this in the past, but this time it's different. And the reason is, first of all, a lot of these pensions are underfunded. Why does the underfunding occur? One reason it occurs is in negotiations between management and the union. When a company has earnings problems and it cannot deliver on higher wages, it promises the workers a higher pension payout in the future. That's something they don't have to deal with for 20 or 30 years.
Well, this can't be coming as a huge surprise. The stock market has been plunging for years now. Why are we only hearing about this now?
Because the companies with these plans are trying to paper over the problem. There's an insurance program that's sponsored by the federal government. That is underfunded, which means that they don't have enough money to cover pension plans when they go under. Pillow Tax went under today, leaving 25,000 workers in the lurch because Pillow Tax, the manufacturer of Canon towels, hasn't fully funded the pension program.
And what happens to these people?
Well, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, it has assets that will cover situations like this in the short run. But those assets could run out in as little as 3 years.
Well, exactly. I was going to say, if this is a much more widespread problem as time goes on, are we talking, what, bailout here?
Yes. Few people believe that any administration or any Congress would let workers get stuck without a pension.
Well, it is certainly hard to imagine. What does this mean for businesses as well?
Well, businesses that participate in this program under an administration plan would have to pay a higher premium. Also, businesses would have to pay more attention to their own funding of the plan and make sure that their funding was more current. They oppose that because it's expensive. And, you know, the economy isn't doing too well right now. The last thing that big business needs is an extra expense. There's a proposal in Congress that would allow them to contribute less to the Pension Guarantee Corp, which they favor. The administration thinks this is papering over the problem and just paving the way for a taxpayer bailout.
Well, what about that? I mean, is this something that is inevitable?
It's hard to say. I mean, Congress seems to be favoring the corporations, favoring a plan that would allow for lower premium contributions, and keeping their fingers crossed and hoping that a stock market rebound would bail everyone out. But there are reasons this time around that a stock market rebound won't bail out companies. And the reason is a lot of the industries with underfunded pension plans are the ones that are endangered from competition overseas. These industries may never be able to survive.
And crossing your fingers doesn't exactly sound like a great corporate policy, does it?
No, it's not a good policy for anyone.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for the update.
Thank you.
Jim McTagg is Washington editor for Barron's Business Weekly.
Still to come, Charlie Hayden, master bass player, gives some lessons on American music.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
In our story on a report claiming sleep-deprived medical residents drove as if they were a little drunk, we talked about new rules limiting resident work hours to 80 per week. Well, Amy of Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, who didn't want her last name used, wrote, "My husband is a resident at a Boston hospital, and the 80-hour rule is not being adhered to. My husband has been working between 90 and 110 hours every week, sometimes goes 2 weeks without a day off, and routinely exceeds 36-hour shifts when on call. He knew he was getting into a difficult process when he began his medical training, but these rules are not designed to protect him. They're designed to protect the patients who are in trouble if their residents' performance on the jobs are being hindered by their exhausted state."
Last week's story on Iran's announcement that it was holding several senior members of the al-Qaeda network drew criticism because of the guest, Gary Sick, director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University. Gary Black of Hickory, North Carolina, writes, "Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't this the same Gary Sick who said in his book, October Surprise, America's Hostages in Iran and the Election of Ronald Reagan, that vice presidential candidate George H.W. Bush flew an SR-71 to Tehran to get the Iranians to hold over the hostages in 1980 so Reagan could win against Carter? You might as well have some right-winger who claimed Hillary Clinton killed Vince Foster come on and expound on her chances of running for president in 2008.
Pastor Moses Pa of Liberia made a desperate call for help for his country on our program yesterday, and that prompted Joe Sullivan of Lynn, Massachusetts, to call.
I've lived in Liberia for many years and have many, many dear close friends, and I hope that you continue to follow the story. It's just a terrible, terrible tragedy, and I'm hoping that the United States will take some responsibility and help. It's just an outrage and a horrible situation, and thank you for making it human. That's the part that gets left out. There are really kind, hardworking, ordinary people who are suffering terribly.
Our coverage about the raid which killed Saddam Hussein's sons, Uday and Qusay, as well as his 14-year-old grandson, Mustafa, drew several responses. Lee Guptill of Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, writes, "What sort of danger to American freedom can there be from a 14-year-old boy? Did the troops involved in the raid know who was in the villa, or was it a matter of shoot now, ask questions later? I realize there are many reasons to support this sort of action. I don't disagree with the use of force when appropriate, but I have to wonder if every other option was considered. Another question comes to mind. Where was his mother?"
Well, the interview with journalist Andrew Coburn, telling of his encounter with Uday and Qusay in a restaurant, drew this response from Margie Howe of Middleborough, Massachusetts.
It's, I think, my new favorite piece that I've heard on NPR, because I've heard something really interesting that's going to prompt me to do some investigating on my own.
Always happy to help. And as always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Today, we bring you a profile that first aired last winter when jazz bassist Charlie Hayden released a compilation of beautiful American songs called American Dreams. Robin joined some students at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, preparing to perform with Hayden.
Charlie Hayden has a motto, which is play music as if you will, this is the last moment you will ever play music. So please play with all your soul. Ladies and gentlemen, the greatest tenor saxophonist in the world, Michael Brecker.
Recently, Matt Glazer, head of the string department at Berklee College of Music in Boston, readied about three dozen students to rehearse with a band of legendary jazz musicians, including Michael Brecker, drummer Brian Blade, pianist Alan Broadbent, and the band leader and legendary bass player.
And the reason we're all here, a musician totally without category on bass and vision, Charlie Hayden.
Charlie Hayden could pass for 40, but he spent most of his 65 years in music. His new CD is a tribute to great American composers, and he's played with many of them. At this rehearsal for an evening concert, a cellist misses her cue and says she was just overwhelmed by the beauty of the music and the company she was playing with.
Do you know what a giant you are in their eyes?
You know, I've never been able to know that. I just want to be a nice guy and make everybody happy. In L.A. at CalArts, and I just did a workshop here at the New England Conservatory. And I said, you know, you really have to take seriously this thing about playing music, because you have to know what you're doing, why you're doing it. Why do you really want to do this? And appreciate the gift that you've been giving. And then I said, so maybe you can picture walking down the street and seeing a mother with her baby in a stroller. And you look down at the baby, and the baby looks up at you, and your eyes meet in that second, and then you pass. In that second is something unbelievably beautiful. And that's what you should try to play. That's what you should have inside you every day. See, the thing that's really difficult is to reach the level that you are when you're touching music in the other part of your life. You know, so when I put my bass down, I'm in trouble. Record a lot of different messages. I've been planning it for a long time. And then September 11th happened, and I started thinking, what a tragedy. How could this have happened? And then I started thinking about what the intentions were of the people that founded this country and how great this country is supposed to be and looks like it is for people all over the world that want to come here. And, you know, then I think about in the 40s, popular music sold millions of records. Nat King Cole, Frank Sinatra, Duke Ellington, the Pied Pipers, Joe Stafford. 75% of record sales. And now, let's just say creative music is 3% of record sales. Young people walk out of their door, they're bombarded with dysfunctional culture, dysfunctional noise, and we have all this to combat. You know, this is kind of like a silent protest, this music that we recorded, because it's about being able to dream. It's about being able to fulfill your dreams and celebrate what is for some people, but what isn't for most people, and what should be.
It's funny you say that the record is a protest, a silent protest of some sort, because someone might say, well, where's the anger? I don't hear any anger in it.
There's no anger. There's just obsession to spread the word of beauty. Even when I've made political records with my Liberation Music Orchestra, I've made three of those. They were all recorded when I started to become worried and concerned and almost like a feeling of helplessness, not being able to do anything about what's going on. So the only way I know how to do something is to play some music. And it's not coming from anger. It's coming from concern. But, you know, I'm not saying I don't have anger. I'm just in a rush to make all the beauty I can make in the little time there is to make it.
Charlie also included the music of Marilyn and Alan Bergman after the songwriting team approached Charlie and wife Ruth at a party.
And they said, man, you guys produce such beautiful records. We want to send you some of our songs. You know, and then I saw this movie on the plane, Tootsie, and I heard this song, you know, It Might Be You. And I said, man, this is a really beautiful song. The other song, Love Like Ours, is so beautiful too. So I consider them great American composers.
Some of their songs, either together or with others, Windmills of Your Mind, The Way We Were.
Yeah.
What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life?
Yeah. They're great. The thing about composers is that, especially American composers, is they compose in a way that's the character of this country. All these guys have this flavor that you can almost taste of America. It's like feeling like you're in the desert, like you're in the country, like you're in the city. But in the United States, it's a special thing, you know, like where I come from in the Ozarks.
American music is of Charlie Hayden's blood. Born in the Ozarks in Missouri, at 22 months, he was singing with his family on the syndicated radio show Corn's a Crackin'. He says he has equal respect for jazz great Ornette Coleman and the work of Catherine Lee Bates and Samuel Augustus Ward, who wrote America the Beautiful. Ask you about America the Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It is beautiful. And then it ends on a note that seems different from the rest of the song.
It's a flat five. It makes it kind of dissonant because the American dream is very complex. There's a lot of things involved. It's not just beautiful. And people have to know that there's a lot of work ahead for everybody before this thing can really be played like it should be played. But I think it sounds great played like that because, you know, you see America, an America that can be healed.
We leave you with Charlie's contribution to the compilation, also called American Dreams, and his signature sign-off. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
I just want to say solid, Jackson.
Solid Jackson.
Squalid Jackson.
Squalid Jackson, that's great. In Italy, it's Solido Jacksoni, and in France, it's Soli Jacques. Scandinavian countries, Denmark, it's Jarlath Saxon. So, you know, it's everywhere.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
Our press
news and these stories here and now.
Our press